This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Davos and slowing global economic growth. Whether the 5G revolution is here or just marketing, and advertisers really aren't that mad at Facebook. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, January 21st, Martin Luther King Day, and a National Day of Service. Thank you if you did some of that today. Service took a slightly different form in Davos, Switzerland, where economists, bankers, and world leaders kicked off their annual meeting to talk about what to expect from the global economy in the coming year. The glass is not, shall we say, half full. Political uncertainty, ongoing trade disputes, news today that China's economic growth is its slowest since 1990, all suggest that a contraction may be upon us. Here is the straight talk from International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde from a press conference this morning.
The bottom line is that after 2 years of solid expansion, the world economy is growing more slowly than expected.
Okay, but so what does that mean? Marketplace's Andy Euler takes a look.
Trade tensions, a U.S. government shutdown, faltering Brexit negotiations. There's not a whole lot of stability in the world's leading economies. Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says he thinks Christine Lagarde and the IMF are actually underestimating how much growth is going to stagnate.
The IMF is reluctant to dramatically reduce its forecasts for fear that it will be criticized for triggering.
The agency lowered global growth expectations by 0.2% this time around. And Lagarde did say that the outlook doesn't mean a global recession is around the corner. But Neil Shearing at Capital Economics in London says this slowdown is different than in the recent past.
What makes this different is the fact that the three major regions of the global economy, China, the US, and Europe, are all slowing in synchronicity. They're all slowing together.
America's steady growth has been taken for granted since the financial crisis, but Maurice Obstfeld at UC Berkeley says that's not the case anymore. He thinks the trade dispute with China is a major factor.
So there's a negotiation going on between the two countries, but if that doesn't lead to some sort of agreement, there could be pretty dire consequences for China, for the U.S., and for the global system.
President Trump set a 90-day deadline after meeting with the Chinese president last month, but it's unclear what will happen if a deal isn't in place by that deadline in March. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
One factor dragging down the personal economy for many people here in the U.S. is the partial government shutdown, now at 31 days and counting, with no end in sight. For the up to 800,000 affected workers, it's becoming a financial crisis. Some banks and creditors are offering furloughed workers loans and payment deferments so they can keep up with their finances. But at the same time, those workers are also becoming the target of scams. Marketplace's Erica Barris has more on that.
Whenever there's a hurricane or wildfire, these sorts of fraudsters appear. That's because
a crisis is a sweet spot for scammers.
Sally Greenberg with the National Consumers League. She says scams like fraudulent short-term loans, fake work-at-home schemes, phony calls from Medicare or the IRS will become especially pronounced as the shutdown continues. Robert Fole teaches business and law at Ohio University. He says for federal workers,
this is a financial crisis for them. And so unlike a hurricane or those sorts of things, really what we're dealing with is the pocketbook.
And that pocketbook may need some relief. Scott Estrada with the Center for Responsible Lending says he's noticed stock prices rise for legitimate payday loan companies, an indicator that
there's already a recognition by investors that this small dollar market is a market opportunity.
For consumers, it may be hard to tell genuine financial products from fraudulent ones. And says Ted Rossman, an analyst with CreditCards.com, the agencies that monitor these fraudulent organizations are partially shut down.
with so many of the workers from the Federal Trade Commission and elsewhere on furlough, there's really nobody to chase down the bad guys who are making robocalls and trying to swindle people out of money.
That leaves consumer protections to states. And it isn't just federal workers that need protection. Also on the scammers' hit list, organizations claiming to raise money for federal employees. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, how food stamp recipients are having to change their budgets because of the shutdown. On Wall Street today, U.S. trading was closed for the MLK holiday, but global markets didn't love the outlook from the IMF. We'll have those details when we do the numbers. If you ask the major U.S. telecom companies, they'll tell you the next generation of mobile wireless technology, 5G, has arrived. Yay! But things are a little messier than that right now. Carriers might still mean different things when they say 5G. There aren't any 5G phones that actually operate on 5G mobile networks. But at the recent CES tech conference in Las Vegas, companies from John Deere to Samsung to Intel were talking about the promise of the new technology. And of course, big telecoms like AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon were promising to be the networks of the future. There are still questions, however, namely when and how much. At CES earlier this month, I was able to ask those questions of Nikki Palmer. She's the chief network officer at Verizon.
I think everybody's heard the words 5G at some point over the last year or two. But give us a sense from your perspective how significant this jump from 4G to 5G is really likely to be.
I think the best way to describe it maybe is to think about the past. And these jumps in technology, we call them Gs or generations in the wireless world. You know, 1G was about basic voice. 2G brought along some simple text messaging. 3G really brought access to the internet, being able to do some basic web browsing on the internet. 4G now offered greater bandwidth and speeds and really ushered in a lot of new innovation. And video, who would have imagined even 10 years ago watching, you know, full-length films on your mobile device? But that's kind of what 4G did. So 5G provides about 1,000 times the capacity of 4G networks.
One of the things you've also talked about as a company is the need to get everybody on the same page with respect to what they need, what they mean when they say 5G. Some of those standards are not finalized yet. How big a concern is it that consumers will have sort of a faux 5G experience and lose trust?
Yeah, I think it's a big concern because in the end, I believe consumers, you know, they want to believe that when they get a 5G phone on a 5G network, that that means something, that it's something different.
The installation in some ways is not without controversy, right? The FCC capped the fees that carriers have to pay to cities, for example, and a lot of cities are pushing back on that, saying, you know, we're subsidizing these networks. What do you say to those cities?
Well, the FCC passed the small cell order, and we really appreciate that order because it provides some clarity in terms of not just rates, but things like shot clocks and other components of building, you know, networks within cities. We have the largest coverage of any wireless carrier, so we're in rural areas like no one else is. I mean, all of these things we don't do because someone told us to do them. We do them because there's customers there and there's value to bring to those customers.
And then that comment about rural coverage leads to sort of one of the other concerns, which is that you might be incentivized then in some ways to build in these more profitable and densely populated areas. And my family's all in Montana and North Dakota. There's only one carrier there. I mean, yes, it's you, right? But that's not okay, right? Like how do you make sure that the digital divide is not exacerbated by the rollout in the biggest cities?
Well, the digital divide is very important to us. In fact, we've done a lot of work in this area. one of the reasons we are introducing a 5G home solution to bring broadband into the home is to address some of that. Because consumers today, you know, across many parts of the United States don't have good access to broadband. Now, are we going to be able to fix that in a year with one fell swoop? No. But the reality is, as we develop these 5G ultra wideband networks, we have tremendous capability that we could bring to consumers, and we certainly plan to do that. You know, our commitment is to bring the best networks to consumers, period, end of story.
Nikki Palmer is Chief Network Officer at Verizon. Thanks so much for the time.
It's been a pleasure.
The world's population now stands at 7.2 billion humans. By the end of the century, it may grow to more than 10 billion, but the growth in population isn't happening everywhere. In a lot of the developed world, the population may already have peaked. In parts of Europe, the US, and China, fertility rates are already far below what's known as replacement level. That is, more people are dying than are being born. And those countries now face a completely different problem: how to support an aging population. Right now, Japan is the oldest country in the world and is trying to figure out how to cope. The BBC's Tokyo correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports.
Deep in the mountains of central Japan, the morning peace is about to be shattered. A little truck is winding its way up the long valley road. At its wheel is 65-year-old Yutaka Ando, beside him his wife Sakiko, and on the roof a speaker is blaring out an old favourite. The Andos pull up in a village square. Within minutes, their little truck is transformed into a mobile supermarket. Four old ladies walked out of their houses, two of them with their backs almost bent double. According to Ando-san, the youngest person in this village is 72 years old. Most of the young have now left these rural valleys for better paid work in the city. Now only the old remain. For them, the Ando's mobile shop is a lifeline.
I think Nanmoki village would be more deserted without us coming here.
We owe a lot to people here. We've known them for over 30 years. So we want to do what we can to help them.
All over Japan, there are more and more villages like this one. By 2040, 40% of Japan's total population will be pensioners. No other country in the world has ever experienced this before. It's not just a question of how they're going to pay to look after all these old people. It's who is going to do the caring. In a quiet street on the northern outskirts of Tokyo, Yoko Sawa is doing her morning rounds. Yoko is a care manager for the local ward. Today she's come to check on a pensioner who recently lost his wife. The old man insists he is fine. Japan can afford care managers like Yoko because it has a well-funded care system. Since 2000, everyone over the age of 40 here has been obliged to pay into it, but it is already under huge strain. The problem is it was designed when Japan's pensioners made up around a fifth of the population. Now they are more than a quarter, and soon they will be a third. And then there is the issue of dementia. I'm now in another neighbourhood of Tokyo, and I'm with another care manager, Ryu Uzawa. And we're outside the house of a 90-year-old gentleman called Kiyomizu Shirai. We've come here because Mr. Shirai's wife has been diagnosed with dementia. In the last 2 months, her condition has got much worse, and it's making caring for her very difficult.
Sometimes she waits outside the front door until late at night. She thinks our children are coming to collect her. I try to persuade her to come in, but she refuses.
Japan's leading expert on old age care told me dementia is now a pandemic and it is spreading across the developed world. There are already 5 million dementia sufferers in Japan. By 2025, that will rise to 7 million. Japan is at the leading edge of the world's demographic transition. Where it goes, other countries will soon follow.
That's Rupert Wingfield Hayes for the BBC. Coming up.
The joke is that we get paid in sunsets. And to a certain extent, that is true.
Nobody becomes a park ranger for the money. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed because of the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday. In Europe, Britain's FTSE is up 0.03% after Prime Minister Theresa May presented Parliament with a Plan B for Brexit. France's CAC 40, though, fell nearly 0.2%, and Germany's DAX declined by 0.6%. Earlier in Asia, the Nikkei closed up 0.3%, its highest close in just over a month. You are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Facebook makes money by selling ads. In fact, it is the second biggest digital ad platform in the world, just behind Google. But 2018 was the year that a lot of people realized just how much Facebook uses our posts, our connections, our photos, location, the quizzes we take to help advertisers target us. Since the Cambridge Analytica scandal, Facebook has made some changes. Some users have given up and left. There was news late last week that U.S. regulators might still fine Facebook over how it treats our personal information. But how are things on the business side? Back at CES in Las Vegas, I sat down with Mark Rabkin, the vice president of ads and business platform at Facebook. And I asked him how advertisers were feeling about Facebook after a year of bad news.
Overall, advertisers have been pretty supportive. And most businesses are actually going through the same kind of stuff. Every business is built on data now from the ground up. So every business is kind of looking at us and saying, how are you guys going to tackle the challenges? Here's some ideas we have. Here's some things you should be doing.
So nobody, not a lot of defection, it sounds like you're saying.
No, not a lot of defection. But definitely a lot of help and a lot of constructive criticism and a lot of pointing out, we think you guys should invest here or you should invest here.
And then talk about some of the changes that have been made in the wake of this sort of series of revelations, business changes. I know that there was, a big change in how much data advertisers could access and use, right, with the getting rid of the partner program. Can you explain that to people?
In 2018, we launched a lot of changes. We improved transparency and controls for GDPR. We launched new privacy checkups. We launched new ways to see the data we have about you online so you can manage it. But we also launched some kind of restrictions on what I call the data supply chain. Basically, we wanted to make sure that advertisers know and take responsibility for the data they use for targeting on Facebook. So instead of allowing advertisers to get data from certain third parties, We had advertisers only bring data to us that they have directly. And this helps us make sure that the advertiser has a clear privacy policy, that they are managing that data with their own customers.
Can they then combine their own data with your data, though, to target on Facebook? I mean, what access do they have to the data that I am contributing to Facebook as a user?
All ads, for instance, that run on Facebook can utilize Facebook data. But they do so in a privacy-safe way where that data never leaves the Facebook walls. Basically, the advertiser can say, here's my best customers. I'd love for you to deliver an ad to them. And then from that list of best customers, we use our data to pick and choose what time of day, who, in what moment to make those ads more relevant and more exciting to people. But the data doesn't really flow back and forth that much.
I think that is a misconception then, yeah, because, I mean, you know, Facebook often says, truthfully, we don't sell data, but I think there is a sense that advertisers who use the platform can then take that data about that they get from profiles and go off and use it in future targeting.
Yeah, absolutely not. And in fact, we have every system designed from the ground up to make sure that doesn't happen.
I wonder, will there also be an audit in a way on the advertiser side, like a look at how effective it really is, how much data is really needed? You know, you're hearing Sundar Pichai very recently say, we don't actually need as much data as you think in order to deliver targeted ads. Do you think that there, we can keep it just to Facebook, that there could be sort of a data minimization effort just around looking at whether all this information is really necessary?
In the modern world, to provide great customer service, you need data. And in fact, customers expect you to do it. At the same time, I think every business has to do, Molly, what you just said, is figure out, what do I really need? How long do I need to keep it? How do I let people control that data? And provide those great experiences people have come to expect while helping people feel totally confident and safe in how it's all working.
Mark Rapkin is VP of Ads and Business Platform at Facebook. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Now, I should note here that the idea of data minimization is part of Europe's new privacy law, the GDPR. And Google CEO Sundar Pichai might have mentioned it, but the company is not quite practicing it. Today, French regulators fined Google about $57 million under the GDPR for not properly telling users how Google collects and uses information from its many sites, like YouTube, Maps, and Search, to sell targeted ads. It's the first major action resulting from GDPR. We have an occasional series here at Marketplace in which we ask folks to share what they do. Some jobs take you outside. Your office is in nature. If you think it sounds good now, keep listening. A park ranger in Hawaii sent us this lesson on how he became one.
My name is Andrew Laval, and I'm a visual information specialist at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park in Hawaii. Previously, I was at Katmai National Park in Alaska. I was working at a university several years ago. I found myself sitting at my desk in my cubicle under fluorescent lights, daydreaming about my next vacation, what national park I was going to explore, where I could go camp, what mountains I could go climb. So I took the leap, big career left turn for me, and I decided to become a park ranger. Broadly speaking, in the Park Service, we have law enforcement rangers. They're also what we call interpretive rangers, which is technically what I am, and it's our job to interpret the history and natural environment. Basically, education and outreach is another way of putting that. And then you also have natural resources staff. So those are the folks who are studying the biology of an ecosystem, monitoring our wildlife, things like that. It's a common myth that you have to major in environmental sciences. We have architects on staff, geologists, wildlife biologists of all stripes. But if your interest is in history or anthropology, you can find a route into the National Park Service through that. As an agency, we are sort of a jack of all trades. You do need to have a certain comfort level with the outdoors. And basically, willingness to have some adventure. The joke is that we get paid in sunsets. And to a certain extent, that is true. A lot of my colleagues and coworkers in the National Park Service get some sort of other fulfillment other than monetary through their jobs. So we enjoy being in these places and we get some sort of perhaps personal or spiritual satisfaction as well. I would say that's really important because you do work in some remote places. Sometimes they're not always the easiest places to work. And some days, you know, the pay isn't all it's cracked up to be, but you get to sit at the rim of the Grand Canyon, look out at the layers of time spread out before you. You get a pretty warm, fuzzy feeling from that a lot of the time.
Now, we also have video to go with this series. You can fly with a blimp pilot or see a dog photographer in action. Spoiler alert, there are some pretty cute dogs in that video. It's all on our YouTube channel, Marketplace APM. This final note before we go, I mentioned at the top of the show that Martin Luther King Day has been designated a National Day of Service since 1994. In fact, it's the only federal holiday to be designated that way. This year, speaking of national parks, cleanup and planting events in parks ranging from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco to Texas had to be canceled because of the government shutdown. Park Service officials in southeastern Texas said they're trying to figure out what to do with 15,000 trees that were supposed to be planted in the 3-million-acre Big Thicket National Preserve. The Park Service canceled its annual Big Thicket Longleaf Pine planting event for the first time in 9 years. And that's it for us this Monday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. And I am Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl, we'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.